EVs, right?
Hydrogen is a possible competitor with EVs to replace gas-fueled cars, but Herkel says hydrogen engines take twice as much energy per mile to fuel and are much more complex to maintain. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael's favorite sport is politics.
The Super Bowl was a rout. Everyone expected a close game, but Philadelphia's defense stifled Kansas City's offense. The bigger game in Washington is a blowout so far. Our democracy has no defense. Trump has fired the referees, so there's no one to charge him with penalties against the Constitution. And Trump's offensiveness shows some strategery mixed in with all the bluster. But it's still early. The courts have yet to take the field, though we can't be sure they're all on our side. Senator Merkley is voting no on every Trump nominee and proposal. Even some Republican lawmakers are questioning Coach Trump's playbook. We have to do more than not panic, than jeer on the sidelines. We need to call out the media who's saying the game's already lost. We need to remind our teammates it's still early in the first quarter. And let's realize those in the MAGA hats have as much to lose as we do, in some ways more, if our democracy is defeated. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 12th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, David Rosenberg, and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Zamone Perez, Suzanne Potter, Judith Ruiz Branch, Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to discuss his latest article. It's called City Approves Land Use Statement for Zenith Energy Despite Public Opposition. After a long process and promises of transparency, City approves controversial land use statement as City Council resolution awaits. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So this new piece of yours runs down what happened in Portland city government last week having to do with Zenith Energy. So the city approved a land use compatibility statement for Zenith. What does that mean for the company?
Yeah, so we've been covering this for a little while, especially the last couple of months as the city administrators in particular have been going through this process. And Zenith has needed this because they were fined by DEQ $372,000 in December. And they kind of needed to clear up some of the uses that they were doing down at their operations on Front Avenue. And in order to get a state permit from DEQ, they needed to get this new thing from the city and sort of clear up some of the tax lot issues that they had and what they were actually legally allowed to do there after they violated the law for 3 years.
So what does a new land use compatibility statement from the city allow Zenith to do?
Yeah, so this is all kind of this ongoing process since 2022, even 2021. But basically, they have promised to, since there's like no new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city of Portland, that's a resolution that was passed, the renewable fuel standard some years ago, Zenith isn't really allowed to build new fossil fuel infrastructure, and so they had to say that they were going to bring in renewable diesel and transition off of that by October 3rd, 2027. There is some question as to if they will specifically only be transporting renewable fuels by that time. And advocates, environmental advocates, really argue that they're basically expanding fossil fuel infrastructure, and if they don't transition in the end, there may be no harm, no foul.
This stuff with Zenith is the subject of a lot of public pushback. Why do advocates find it so controversial what the city's done?
Well, it kind of originated, after this tour that Stewart's kind of uncovered alongside some other environmental advocates and other reporting from Nick Cunningham and Dee Smog in 2023, looking back at public records from 2022, when Zenith was in a lot of trouble. They were suing the city. The city was winning against Zenith. The Land Use Board of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court were hearing this case and basically said that the city had the right to deny Zenith its land use permit in 2021. By 2022, Zenith took these city officials on a tour and basically made that promise to transition to renewable fuels. The city said, okay, fine by us. And it kind of had no teeth. And advocates say that really Zenith has violated the law the entire time they've been here. They took over a former asphalt terminal in 2014. And ever since, I think they have something like 18 different violations, things that they've promised to do and then failed to do. So the idea that they're going to, this will really be the first step in them abiding by local and state and federal laws, is a little bit tough for environmental advocates to swallow.
With Zenith being such a big issue, I mean, it was something that many of our current local elected leaders ran on as a part of their campaign. What has been the reaction from city elected officials? What was their involvement here?
This is really an interesting place. And I, was on KBOO actually last week. If any listeners wanted to go back and listen to Barbara Bernstein's great show, Locus Focus, we talk in pretty great detail about this. But there's a lot of tension between the city council and the power that they have and the city administrator, the sort of executive branch of this new form of government. Two city councilors, Mitch Green and Angelita Murillo, submitted a resolution on January 31st directing the mayor to investigate Zenith's potential violations of its franchise agreement. That would be kind of a big violation, if that was the case. And that was a Friday, and by Monday, the city administrators, particularly interim deputy city administrator Donnie Oliveira, went through and just approved this land use statement despite there being a resolution, submitted to the council to open an investigation into how this whole thing went down.
Just for clarity's sake, what is a franchise agreement? What would that investigation look at if council adopts it?
Right. It probably just sounds like a funny, random permit, but franchise agreements are something that every, utility person entity in Portland and beyond has to submit to the city in order to do business like building under ground. So like to use the city's rights of way, there are all kinds of cables and pipelines, fiber optics, all these kinds of things under the ground. Zenith quite possibly violated that agreement by doing exactly the thing that DEQ fined them for, which was constructing new pipes and operating them for 3 years while all of this process was actually going on. So it seems like a silly little thing, but digging into the ground where there's all kinds of gas lines and stuff like that is quite a significant violation.
Well, Zenith was front and center at last week's city council meeting, where city administrator Michael Jordan's contract extension was up for a vote. How did it impact the proceedings?
It was sort of a big piece of that Confirmation, actually, because I think it was the first example where there was really a stress point between the close responsiveness of the city council to the people who elected them to be there, and this sort of old way of doing business, this sort of bureau commission form of government that we had for the last 100 years, where the executive branch had a lot more power and they were able to just sort of do these things kind of administratively without the public really having a lot of involvement. There were a lot of really good questions from city councilors to Michael Jordan on how this process could happen in this way, and whether or not that's sort of how things are, how they expect things to be in the future. He seemed somewhat committed to at least developing some rules. This new form of government is still developing a lot of rules around how these kinds of decisions are made. But in the end, you know, the city did choose to push through this land use statement on February 3rd to meet DEQ's deadline of February 4th. And again, that wasn't the city's deadline. That was Zenith's deadline.
Zenith has promised to switch to renewable diesel at this terminal, which you spoke to a little bit. How does that line up with the city's climate goals?
This is sort of an open question, in that there is a lot of there is a narrative out there that renewable diesels are going to materially impact, you know, climate change in a positive way. A lot of environmental advocates say that renewable diesel is much more of a greenwashing campaign, and that the actual benefits of it with regard to CO2 reduction in the emissions that are, you know, being emitted into the environment, it may not be any better, and could even potentially be worse if you take into account how the fuels are made and all of the kinds of the ways that the CO2 actually then leaks in the atmosphere. So it's hard to tell. There is a sort of narrative, and it seems that a lot of city administrators and even DEQ and the state and the Port of Portland are all kind of operating from this idea that this is going to be better. Materially better is still really an open question.
I mean, the renewable diesel function was the subject of a letter supporting Zenith getting a new land use statement from the Portland Metro Chamber. Isn't that right?
Right. Portland Metro Chamber did send a letter. It was dated January 27th, and they sent it on January 28th, saying, you know, as our region transitions to electrification, one of the best ways to reduce emissions is low-carbon renewable fuels. They say that it aligns with the renewable fuel standard, trying to eliminate traditional diesel by the year 2030. So, you know, in their letter, they said renewable diesel can be used in existing vehicles and reduce emissions up to 80% over traditional fossil-based fuel. That's sort of a funny question, because if you measure, or a funny assertion, if you measure renewable fuels out of a tailpipe, it might reduce by 80%. But again, what environmental advocates are really focused on is the lifespan of the entire process. And in that case, it may not actually be any better. So there's a lot of kind of funky science, which is totally, just sort of totally aligns with how the fossil fuel industry has operated for, you know, 50 years they've been denying climate change.
Could you describe some of the overlapping stakeholders in all of this? It isn't just the city of Portland and environmental advocates, right?
The Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, which is a coalition of four tribes along the Columbia River, has been very outspoken about their opposition to Zenith. They maintain water rights, and in the instance of, you know, any sort of pollution in the water or explosions, fires leaking into the water, you know, this is something that really impacts, you know, tribal fishing and the salmon there. And, you know, for a lot of tribes, that is a really central piece of, you know, sustenance and culture. And so it is, you know, in their letters that they've sent to the city and their interactions with these kind of intergovernmental agreements, they are really opposed to this. And yeah, so I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons that this land use statement was denied in the first place in 2021, is that the city had not actually conducted, interacted with tribes around this. And so they couldn't really find a good way to approve this land use statement. So there is a lot of, there are other governments here besides just the city and just the state, and they seem to be a little bit edged out here.
Well, Zenith has a new land use compatibility statement in their hands. Where do things go from here?
It's hard to tell from here because, you know, DEQ said that they're going to be reviewing the LUX land use statement to ensure that it's complete and then provide confirmation of this. A lot of administrators, you know, city, statewide, look at whether or not it says what it's supposed to do and whether or not that's what they're doing, and then kind of rubber stamp it. So there's not a lot of opposition there. The city is concerned about lawsuits from fossil fuel companies. I don't know if that's something that environmental advocates, you know, would also intend to do. I know that litigation is quite expensive, but they did send a letter to the city not long ago outlining how there are some actual legal factors here that they should consider on their part. So we'll kind of see how it goes. But
are there aspects of this story that you think are not getting enough attention?
You know, this letter from the Portland Metro Chamber is really interesting to me, particularly in light of some public records that are not in this reporting. You may only hear this on KBOO. But, you know, right before this, on January 16th, John Isaacs from the Portland Metro Chamber reached out to Donnie Oliveira, asking to get drinks after work and saying that he felt a sense of urgency over something that's a little bit unclear. And then they met on January 23rd, and that's 2 days after the city council held a listening session, a work session on Zenith Energy. So they met on January 23rd. Donnie sent John Isaacs Council President Ilana Pertl-Guinney's email address on January 28th, and then just minutes later, the Portland Business Alliance, sent by John Isaacs and signed by the CEO Andrew Hone, arrived in Ilana Pertl-Guinney's inbox. So I do think that this represents, again, this kind of old way of doing business, which is that a city administrator can go in, have drinks with somebody, you know, talking about city business that a lot of the public really cares about, kind of off the clock, and then have the Portland Metro Chamber actually, you know, push through basically exactly what they want after he met with Donnie. So I think there's kind of a lot in there that hasn't really been covered anywhere but here, but it is a really interesting aspect of this, particularly as the new city council is trying to have power to be more responsive to the people here in Portland.
What do you hope folks take away from this piece?
The Zenith story, I think, is really interesting because it hits on a lot of levels. It's a, you know, this is an environmental question. This is sort of a future of fossil fuels in America and around the world kind of question. You know, in the instance of a catastrophic earthquake, this is just a real, like, kind of climate catastrophe sort of question. And then at the same time, it represents, again, this idea that we have a city council based on ranked choice voting that is meant to represent the four different districts with, you know, three councilors in each district. And the whole point of that is to be more responsive to the people. And there's a power struggle that's happening right now between the city administrator, the mayor's office, you know, and administrators with the city council. And it's still kind of to be determined, you know, what kind of democracy we're going to have here for the next 100 years after we addressed, you know, the challenges of trying to have a democracy for the previous 100 years.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find this for themselves?
The best way to get a newspaper is from a vendor in your neighborhood. They accept cash, Venmo, and tips. We have it all. Original content, no wire stories this week. There's a lot of really great reporting and a lot of hard work has gone into this. And it's cold outside. So I highly recommend people just go buy a copy from a vendor.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called City Approves Land Use Statement for Zenith Energy Despite Public Opposition. After a long process and promises of transparency, City Approves Controversial Land Use Statement as City Council Resolution awaits. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Now that there is at least an official ceasefire in Gaza, many observers have noticed that Israel appears to be turning its attention more and more toward the West Bank. Secretary of State Marco Rubio recently lifted sanctions that had been imposed on violent West Bank Israeli settlers. And Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has said that Israel is a step away from annexing the Palestinian territory. Anel Shaleen is a research fellow for the Middle East at the Quincy Institute, who resigned from the State Department over what she called former President Biden's unconscionable Gaza policy. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Let me first ask you, when you did resign over the Gaza policy, what was the reaction from your colleagues?
It was interesting because I had left, I had emailed several colleagues just letting them know I was resigning over Gaza and had given them a personal email address where they could reach me if they so desired, since obviously my State Department email address was not going to work anymore. And several colleagues did reach out to express their support and their gratitude. That ended fairly quickly. I assume, and my understanding from friends is the message from higher up was clear that what I had done was inappropriate, and the State Department does not condone people going public. You know, public resignations are not sort of in the mode of the State Department, where you have access to this classified information and you also have the dissent channel. And so the idea is that you should express your dissent internally, and that it's out of keeping with the character of someone serving in the State Department to sort of go public and splash something like this across the headlines.
And so there was some internal discussion before you left, right? Not just from yourself, but from others, would you say?
Oh, certainly. I was part of very active groups within State Department. Many of us were just connected over signal threads. These were not necessarily people who were in person communicating, but there was a significant amount of distress and shock at what the Biden administration was facilitating and supporting and directly enabling. And, you know, I had made it known that I was going to be resigning in protest, but I hadn't initially planned to go public with the resignation. I hadn't been at the State Department for very long, and I didn't think that anyone would care that I was opposed to this policy. But it was colleagues at State who said, please go public with your resignation. And so I decided I would. And it did end up getting more attention than I would have expected.
I guess along with all the other resignations from the State Department and the UN for that matter.
Well, yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, the very first resignation was Josh Paul, who resigned within weeks of October 7th, who I very much commend. And I had been in touch with Josh before I resigned, just letting him know that I was also going to be resigning. And at the time that I resigned, there were three of us. So it was Josh and then Tarek Habash, who is Palestinian American, who resigned from the Department of Education. And then I resigned. And then following that, you saw several additional people resigning publicly. But many others have also resigned privately. They haven't necessarily gone public with it, but they have decided they could no longer be part of what the government was doing.
Did you get the impression that the higher-ups in the U.S. government are actually in favor of what the Israelis are doing or have done, and that they feel compelled to make public statements suggesting otherwise, that they're concerned about the humanitarian crisis, but really they do like the idea of the Israelis clearing out Gaza, so to speak?
I think it depends who we're speaking of. Obviously, the U.S. government is vast, and there are many people in senior positions who may have privately disagreed, but did not go so far as to speak out against it. But I do think, obviously, it's clear that those who were in the direct decision-making role on this policy, so people from the National Security Council, in particular people like Brett McGurk or Jake Sullivan, Amos Hochstein, and obviously President Biden himself, were all supportive. And what's been interesting is to observe in the past few weeks, in the waning days of the Biden administration, as you had several of these officials try to portray what they had done in a positive light, and often receiving some pushback that their legacy will be genocide. And instead, they're trying to make the argument that this has been to U.S. benefit, that the reduction in the strength of Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran is all something that the U.S. should celebrate. I think, contrary to that, the real effect has been an extreme undermining of the U.S. leadership on the global stage, and any pretension the U.S. had to uphold international law or to be an advocate for human rights or to try to hold other countries accountable on concerns of international law or human rights has been completely destroyed. And so in the longer run, I do think that the level of damage done to America's reputation and the way other countries view America is far more significant than any sort of nominal reduction in the numbers of Hamas, given in particular that Blinken himself acknowledged that recruitment for Hamas is higher now than before October 7th. So their narrative that this has somehow made sort of advanced U.S. interests in the region, I think is truly flawed, given the level of instability we've observed, given the way that the U.S. has had to bulk up its force posture in the Middle East at a time when many security experts are arguing that the Middle East really is not such a crucial arena or region for the U.S. to focus so many resources or so much attention on. You know, I think these are our officials trying to launder their legacy, and I don't think they'll be successful in the long run.
So now we're in the ceasefire phase in Gaza, or so-called ceasefire. And do you think that there was a kind of a deal made when Trump came in that he was communicating with the Israeli leaders and saying that, okay, we could have this ceasefire, but you could do whatever you want in the West Bank? And besides, the ceasefire may not last.
I mean, that certainly seems to be how Netanyahu and his cohort have taken that. I don't know what I'm hearing from certain people who may or may not have good information here, is that Trump did not necessarily explicitly make any sort of quid pro quo, you know, accept a ceasefire in Gaza, but you have open season in the West Bank. They're saying that it's not what he said, but it's regardless of what he said, it seems quite clear that that is how the Israeli government took it. And I do worry very much that from the perspective of the extreme right wing exemplified by Netanyahu's government, that the West Bank is a bigger priority for them anyway. And what's especially alarming is that you hear U.S. officials echoing these extreme right-wing talking points, people from Senator Tom Cotton referring to Judea and Samaria, to use sort of Israel's preferred word for the words for the West Bank. But even people like former President Bill Clinton used the words Judea and Samaria to refer to the West Bank. And this was obviously the president responsible for the Oslo Accords and this ostensible pathway towards a future Palestinian state, which I think just makes clear how deceptive Oslo was all along, since clearly the United States did not use any pressure to actually ensure that Israel pushed forwards towards the establishment of a Palestinian state. So I do worry that the ceasefire is not likely to last in Gaza, and that you now have the transfer of a lot of Israel's attention to this increased level of violence and displacement in the West Bank.
Yeah, it does seem like Israeli officials, or some of them, have made clear that even if they allow the ceasefire to go on for as long as it's supposed to, they'd like to resume the war. And I don't know what Trump's reaction to that would be, but he sometimes refers to, we have to end these stupid wars, whether he's talking about Ukraine or Israel-Gaza. And so you wonder whether he'll just get impatient and try to do something to end it. Do you get that sense? Or does he just not care? Is he so locked in with the Israeli position?
I mean, it's very hard to know. Obviously, I think there was a lot of concern based on Trump's picks for his various cabinet appointments, many of whom are extremely anti-Palestine, very pro-Israel. Obviously, people like Mike Huckabee, who denies the idea of the existence of the Palestinians, and Elise Stefanik for UN ambassador. At the same time, what I've heard is these were selections made to appease major donors, people like Miriam Adelson, who's provided hundreds of millions of dollars to both this recent campaign and Trump's previous campaigns, who very much supports Israel annexing the West Bank. But at the same time, there are also, we know that Trump fancies himself the ultimate deal maker, that he sees it as his right to win a Nobel Peace Prize, the same way President Obama and President Carter did, and some kind of resolution to the conflict would perhaps justify him winning a peace prize if it was in fact a true resolution. I know he has his eye on Israeli-Saudi normalization, and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia has been very clear that that will not happen without the establishment of a state of Palestine, although I think he may have been staking out that position. I don't know that he will necessarily adhere to that. He may be willing to be satisfied by some sort of nominal process, something similar to Oslo, where neither Israel nor the United States has any intention to actually make progress towards the establishment of a state of Palestine, but that the Saudis would be able to say that they made some progress there.
And Trump has also spoken about Gaza as a prime real estate territory, I guess.
Exactly.
His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, would that be something that would suggest he would go along with what the Israelis want to do, or would it be something that he could sell as a way of helping Palestinians as well?
I mean, you're not wrong that he has described Gaza in those terms, as has Jared Kushner. Again, it's just very hard to know like what exactly his plans are there. I mean, I think, you know, what we can be sure of is that Trump is not interested in being seen as weak the way Biden was seen as just bad.